a long list of achievements, and his achievements are truly a source of honor for the Islamic Republic of Iran. One of his many achievements was the strengthening of the resistance front, resistance to U.S. and Israeli hegemony in the West Asia region. As a top commander of the IRGC, the head of the elite Quds force of the IRGC, Lieutenant General Soleimani played a crucial role in strengthening and expanding the axis of resistance. In fact, he was instrumental in strengthening both the Lebanese Hezbollah movement, the Hezbollah resistance forces in Lebanon, and the Palestinian resistance groups in the occupied territories. It's no exaggeration to say that Hezbollah's victory over the Israeli regime in the 33-day war in the summer of 2006, as well as the Palestinian resistance victory over the Israeli regime in the 22-day war in the Gaza Strip, was a direct result of Mahdi Soleimani's efforts, which bore fruit. Also, the war in Syria, which the West hoped would result in regime change in Damascus, actually was transformed into a triumph for the Islamic Resistance Front, and it led to the complete destruction of Daesh terrorists, thanks largely to the efforts of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his forces in Syria and in the region. Thanks to his efforts and those who helped him, effectively, the idea that the West was going to carry out regime change in Damascus suddenly turned. It was transformed into something completely different. It became a triumph for the Islamic Resistance Front.
Yes, the unmatched General Qasem Soleimani, whose very name would send shivers to the hearts of terrorists and their masters everywhere in the world. 3 years after the martyrdom of the great commander of the resistance front, and in fact, the symbol of this front, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, his name and fame have spread all across the planet more than ever. He was the great man who feared nothing. This is why the people of the region and the world know him for his courage and valor, actually. Actually, Mahdi Soleimani was a realistic idealist. He enjoyed abundant natural potential to turn his lofty ideals and goals into operational plans.
That's right. Another one of his long list of achievements, of course, was the uprooting of Daesh terrorists or ISIS terrorists in the West Asia region. Forces under the command of Lieutenant General Soleimani played a key role in liberating many cities in Iraq. For example, the city of Mosul, the city of Tikrit, the city of Samarra, Karbala, and Jarf al-Sakh in Iraq. All of these were liberated thanks to the efforts of the forces being commanded by Lieutenant General Soleimani. He effectively liberated these Iraqi cities from Daesh occupation. He also headed the Umm al-Ma'arek operation, which prevented the fall of the city of Erbil in northern Iraq into Daesh hands, also very important. And a fitting statement from the Iraqi Prime Minister, Mohammad Shia al-Sudani. The Iraqi Prime Minister has praised the martyr general by saying, "The untiring efforts of Mahdi Soleimani, hand in hand with Iraq's popular mobilization forces, the Hashd al-Shaabi, has resulted in security for Iraq, the uprooting of Daesh terrorists. And it's an excellent example which shows the brotherhood and friendship between the two peoples of Iran and Iraq." As the Iraqi Prime Minister, Mohammad Shia al-Sudani, has said, "This shows clearly that both nations, Iran and Iraq, are moving in step with one another. They assist each other whenever the need arises."
Yes, and regarding the abundant natural potential to turn his lofty ideals and goals into operational plans, in a part of verse 249 of chapter Baqarah of the Noble Quran, God says, "How many small party has overcome a larger party by Allah's will?" Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani put this verse into practice in his life, actually. For years, it was said that the Zionist regime was the fourth military power in terms of strategy and tactics. It was propagated all over the world, especially among the regional nations, that the illegitimate regime of Israel is absolutely invincible. But the great commander of resistance front, Qasem Soleimani, first challenged this lie through strengthening of resistance units in Lebanon and Palestine. And then he annulled this big lie with the help of these forces. Today, the Israeli regime's terrorist military is facing a group of people who have been inspired by the thoughts of the Holy Defense in 1980s and strongly believe in divine promises. The sound of annihilation of the Zionist regime can be heard in the streets of the occupied Palestine.
That's right. I think certainly here in the Islamic Republic of Iran, in the Muslim world, everyone agrees that the martyred general, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, did more than any single person to combat Daesh terrorists in West Asia and to thwart the designs, the plots and schemes of the United States in this region. Actually, many people in Europe itself and in America have also realized this. I think many Europeans and some Americans have realized that it was their government, the US government, with the help of the British and the French, which created Daesh terrorists in the first place. They were the ones, the Americans, the British and the French, were instrumental in creating Daesh. And General Soleimani actually did more than any other person in the world to combat this. Interesting statement from a member of the European Parliament, Mike Wallace, a member of the European Parliament. He's from the Republic of Ireland. Mike Wallace, MEP. He says this about Martyr General Soleimani. Mike Wallace says, "No one has done more than General Soleimani to defeat Daesh terrorists in Iraq. The United States and its allies actually created Daesh terrorists, and they armed them and they trained them." Surprisingly, Mike Wallace says, the world failed to condemn the brutal assassination of Lieutenant General Soleimani by the U.S. military. Of course, Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, was martyred in a drone attack at Baghdad International Airport in the early hours of the morning on the 3rd of January 2020. And Mike Wallace says, considering how much this general did in defeating Daesh terrorists, it's very surprising that the world failed to forthrightly condemn this horrendous, this shameful U.S. assassination of this general who had done so much to fight terrorism in West Asia region.
Yeah. Qasem Soleimani was described as the nightmare of the fabricated regime of Israel, the most powerful general of the West Asia region, and the architect of Iran's strongest strategy. These epithets imply his preeminent role in West Asia, North Africa region. The American officials, both military and non-military, had asked to meet with General Qasem Soleimani several times, but he had rejected all of them. Martyr Soleimani even didn't answer then U.S. Foreign Secretary John Kerry's letter begging to meet him. This while, he would meet with many senior officials of various countries, for example, like Russia. Qasem Soleimani was not a diplomat, but his statesmen during the meetings with the officials of different countries would affect regional plans seriously. He believed that Americans needed the photos of meeting as a tool for propaganda more than negotiations. He maintained that Americans are not honest even in war, and they would betray those who are with them in the same front. This has been done several times in their dealing with the Pakistani and Iraqi militaries. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani knew the enemy well and was quite aware of its intrigues. He was of the opinion that the United States has a multivalent policy. Hence, when it fails in a sin, it tries to push the rival back in another one. Soleimani said that decisiveness is the only answer to the U.S. plots in the region. Therefore, the messages that Russians conveyed to Americans on his behalf were always decisive and unequivocal. When the former U.S. President Donald Trump started threatening Iran while ranting in a speech, Qasem Soleimani, in one of his speeches in 2018, reminded him of the U.S. disgraceful presence in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen. In fact, he mentioned the reasons for his enmity with the U.S. Addressing the U.S. President, Martyr Soleimani said, "As a soldier of this nation, I answer you. Are you threatening us with a measure that has been unprecedented in the world? Ask the military commanders, the American politicians, the heads of the American security organizations, the KGB and the CIA, and do not utter what you do not know. Have you left anything undone that you could do?" That was the
That's one, right,
of the famous statements.
That's right, a very famous statement from Lieutenant General, the Martyr General Qasem Soleimani. He openly challenged the Americans, and he stood very staunchly. He stood to them very staunchly, and he said that he would prevent the Americans from achieving their goals and plots in this region. Let's now go for a short break. We'll be back.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression and hegemony, even one voice becomes powerful. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Voice of the voiceless.
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We'll now go back to our regular programming here on IRIB English Radio, but we will continue with our roading coverage of the third anniversary of martyrdom of the top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. We will continue with our roading coverage throughout today. For now, we will go back to our regular programming, but we will be back with our roading coverage as well later on.
In the limelight.
The U.S. energy giant ExxonMobil is suing the European Union in a bid to stop its new windfall tax on oil firms. A windfall tax is imposed on firms that benefited from something they were not responsible for. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. oil major ExxonMobil is suing the European Union in a bid to force it to scrap the bloc's new windfall tax on oil groups, arguing Brussels exceeded its legal authority by imposing the levy. Record profits this year by oil companies benefiting from high energy prices have boosted inflation around the world and led to fresh calls to further tax the sector. The windfall profits tax is counterproductive, discourages investments and undermines investor confidence, ExxonMobil spokesperson Casey Norton said on Wednesday, 28th of December. ExxonMobil will factor in the new tax as it considers future multi-billion euro investments in Europe's energy supply and transition, he said. Casey Norton added, whether we invest here primarily depends on how attractive and globally competitive Europe will be. The Financial Times was first to report the lawsuit on Wednesday, 28th of December. Windfall profit taxes imposed by Europe could cost at least $2 billion through to the end of 2023, the chief financial officer, Catherine Michels, said in a call to analysts on 8th of December. ExxonMobil said it invested $3 billion in the past decade in refinery projects in Europe. The projects are helping it deliver more energy products at a time when Europe struggles to reduce its imports from Russia, the company said. The ExxonMobil spokesman, Norton, added, we will continue to work with EU leaders to address these issues. Thoughtful policy is critical. Chevron Corporation had also warned that taxing oil production would serve only to reduce energy supply by discouraging company investments. That goes against the intent of increasing suppliers and making energy more affordable, Chevron's chief financial officer, Pierre Breber, told Reuters news agency back in October. Website Politico has also covered the same story. U.S. oil giant ExxonMobil has challenged the European Commission's proposal to levy excess profits from European Union-based oil and gas firms at the General Court of the European Union, the company said on Wednesday, 28th of December. The lawsuit, filed through subsidiaries in Germany and the Netherlands, argues that the measure is a tax, which is a right reserved for national governments, and contests the use of the EU Treaty's Article 122, an emergency procedure that excludes the European Parliament to enact the legislation. Under EU's Treaty Article 122, the European Commission initiates a legislative proposal, but it is the Council that adopts the measure via a qualified majority vote of EU member countries. Our affiliates, ExxonMobil Producing Netherlands BV and Mobil Erdgas Erdol GmbH, are suing the European Council in a bid to annul a new windfall tax on oil and gas companies, said ExxonMobil spokesman Casey Norton in Texas on Wednesday, 28th of December. EU countries back in September passed an emergency package of legislation aimed at tackling soaring energy prices. It included a temporary minimum 33% tax, dubbed a solidarity contribution, on profits of fossil fuel and refinery companies that exceeded a four-year historical average by 20%. The relevant profits could be from fiscal years 2022 or 2023, depending on the country. This litigation is driven by our concern about the unintended long-term effects of this policy on the competitiveness of European industry, the spokesman said. This tax will undermine investor confidence, discourage investment, and increase reliance on imported energy and fuel products. The lawsuit does not prevent the legislation from taking effect, and without any time limits on the court to decide the case, it could be years before a judgment is pronounced. The legislative package at issue also includes taxes dubbed revenue limits for electricity generators and financial relief for certain retail consumers. The European Commission maintains that the measures in question are fully compliant with EU law. According to Arianna Podesta, a European Commission spokesperson. In an email, Arianna Podesta added that the measure aims to ensure the whole energy sector pays its fair share in these difficult times for many to address the extraordinary energy crisis resulting from the weaponization of energy supply. The Commission estimates the temporary measure could bring in up to €25 billion to be redistributed by member countries. We recognise that the energy crisis in Europe is weighing heavily on families and businesses throughout Europe, and we've been working to increase energy supplies to Europe, ExxonMobil spokesman Norton said. Norton added, our challenge is targeted only at the counterproductive windfall profit tax and not any other elements of the package to reduce energy prices. The case concerns one of the first instances of the European Union's use of the emergency Article 122 for energy legislation, potentially making it a test case. The windfall tax will not remedy any shortage of energy supply and cannot realistically achieve a timely impact, so the European Commission and the European Council were wrong to use exceptional powers under Article 122 to speed its approval, Norton added. EU countries have also used the emergency procedure to mandate minimum natural gas storage levels, cuts in winter electricity and gas use, the joint purchasing of gas supplies, and a maximum cap on wholesale natural gas prices within the European bloc. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. US oil major ExxonMobil is suing the European Union in a bid to force it to scrap the bloc's new windfall tax on oil groups, arguing Brussels exceeded its legal authority by imposing the levy. Record profits this year by oil companies benefiting from high energy prices have boosted inflation around the world and led to fresh calls to further tax the sector. The windfall profits tax is counterproductive, discourages investments and undermines investor confidence, ExxonMobil spokesperson Casey Norton said on Wednesday, 28th of December. ExxonMobil will factor in the tax as it considers future multi-billion euro investments in Europe's energy supply and transition, he added. The European Commission has said it has taken note of the lawsuit. It will be now up to the General Court of the European Union to rule on this case. The Commission maintains that the measures in question are fully compliant with EU law, Commission spokeswoman Arianna Podesta said in a statement on Thursday, 29th of December. Windfall profit taxes imposed by Europe could cost at least $2 billion through the end of 2023, according to the Chief Financial Officer, Catherine Michels. In a statement to analysts, on 8th of December.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. It's almost 2 years now since General Qasem Soleimani, the commanding officer of the Quds Force, was assassinated by a US drone attack. Soleimani is an iconic and inspirational figure who led the efforts to defeat the ISIS menace that was unleashed following the illegal invasion of Iraq by US and British military forces in 2003. In today's programme, we're going to explore Soleimani's role in the development of the resistance to US imperialism in West Asia. And we'll also highlight how he was involved in supporting the Palestinian resistance. I'll be asking two political analysts for their assessment of Qasem Soleimani's influence after this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra on Soleimani's role in developing the axis of resistance.
The killing of Qasem Soleimani by a drone strike on the 3rd of January 2020 was carried out on the direct orders of President Donald Trump. But who was Soleimani? And what role did he play in the development of the axes of resistance and the direct material support for the liberation of Palestine? Soleimani was from humble origins. His father was a farmer, and he began working in construction at the age of 13. In his early 20s, he joined the Revolution Guard following the revolution in 1979 and fought in the Iran-Iraq War from 1980s, rising through the ranks. He was appointed commander of the IRGC's Quds Force in 1998, following which he played a significant and direct role across all the region. In Lebanon, Soleimani sent military support to Hezbollah to help eject the Zionist invasion of southern Lebanon in 2006. He himself was present in Lebanon to manage the conflict. For Hezbollah, Qasem Soleimani was the field commander of the Axis of Resistance. He reportedly coordinated the war from a base in Damascus with Syrian officers, Hezbollah, and Iraqi forces. In 2015, he was the main architect of the joint intervention involving Russia as a new partner with Assad and Hezbollah. Soleimani personally briefed President Putin on the strategy. In Iraq, he fostered the resistance to the US presence. The world has cause to be grateful to Haj Qasem for this triumph. In Palestine, Soleimani was also key. If it were not for him, what kind of material kinetic resistance in Palestine would there be without Iranian support? This, of course, the reason for the vilification and demonization of the Islamic Republic by the West. As Saleh al-Aruri, the deputy head of Hamas, put it in 2017, Iran is the most hostile country in the world towards the Zionist entity. Iran is the only country that says this entity is cancerous and should be uprooted from the region. It is Iran and Hezbollah that confront that entity along with us. Hamas issued a statement following the assassination, emphasizing that Qasem Soleimani played a major and critical role in supporting Palestinian resistance at all levels. Ziad al-Nakhili, the head of Palestinian Islamic Jihad's head, stated that the US's decision to kill Soleimani is an indication of the major role this man played in strengthening the resistance axes and the struggle for Palestine. Soleimani was a hugely popular figure in Iran and beyond, with even Western polling showing overwhelmingly favorable views in 2019. But his legacy is much wider than Iran. His role and his memory have already cast long shadows over US involvement in the region, and especially over the Zionist regime in Palestine.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's also the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest contributor today is Amar Kazmi, and he's joining us via Skype. Amar's an anti-imperialist political activist, and he's just finished a master's degree in law. Amar previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign, and was one of my political advisers in my parliamentary office. Welcome to the show. David, tell us something about Qasem Soleimani's background and how he came to lead the Quds Force.
He went into construction at 13, leaving school with hardly any qualifications, in order to pay back debts that his father had by that stage incurred. By 1980, he joins the Republican Guard after the revolution And he rises through the ranks, being in the Iran-Iraq war. You can see him there at the age of 18 on the back wall. And he rises through the ranks and through his activities in the Iran-Iraq war and his heroism there. And eventually, after this period, he's eventually appointed to the head of the Quds Force, which, of course, is the external military force of the Iranian Republican Guards. And he therefore, is in pole position for developing the strategy of the axis of resistance, as it's called, throughout the region.
Ammar, I mean, what was Soleimani's relationship with Hezbollah like? I mean, because his role in directly fighting Israel in Lebanon is celebrated there, isn't it?
Well, the story of Haj Qasem Soleimani and Hezbollah is part of the wider story of Iran's relations with the Lebanese organization. Of course, Hezbollah's own emergence in around 1982 was inspired by the politics and the theology of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979. The Iranian government was heavily involved in establishing and funding Hezbollah, and of course it remains a strong ally of Iran to this day. And Iran and Hezbollah have collaborated extensively over the years, as your film mentioned. And one of those occasions was in 2006 during the July War with the State of Israel. Qasem Soleimani was in Lebanon for the duration of the war. He directed operations, he engaged in liaison, and he helped to develop a collective resistance in which different forces were fighting alongside each other.
David, I mean, is it true that Vladimir Putin sent for Soleimani to explain to him how the Russians should intervene in Syria?
Apparently so. The Russians took a decision in principle that they were going to go into Syria, and Putin apparently said, okay, we're going to do this. I need it explained to me by Soleimani. And Soleimani was flown to Moscow to personally brief Putin on the strategy they would adopt in Syria to beat back the NATO intervention, which was trying to topple the government there.
Oh, very interesting, yeah. Well, Ammar, I mean, how did Soleimani contribute to the defeat of ISIS in Iraq and Syria then?
Well, it's not an overstatement to say that Haj Qasem Soleimani was the architect of the defeat of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And no doubt, of course, he had help from many of the people. In Iraq, for example, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was actually martyred alongside Qasem Soleimani in that drone strike, was integral to defeating ISIS. And of course, thousands of people on the ground, like those in the popular mobilization forces, sacrificed a great deal to defeat the ISIS cancer. But Qasem Soleimani's role was quite unique. You know, over the years, he was on the ground, literally all over the place in Iraq and Syria, building connections, planning and strategizing, providing inspiration and morale. You know, sometimes it's possible to attribute too much to a single individual, but I don't think this is one of those cases.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think to that point that Ammar just made there about attributing too much to one individual? I mean,
this is traditionally the mistake of the great men theories of history. But in this case, you know, he clearly was very, very central in Iraq, in Lebanon, indeed in Palestine, in bringing the resistance together. I mean, the background of some of the people who he was working with were, you know, apparently across the sectarian divide, the much vaunted sectarian divide in Islam between the Sunni and Shia, and he worked, you know, seamlessly across that divide. The support from Hamas, predominantly a Sunni organization, is unparalleled, I think, for any other particular leader in the Iranian government. So I think this is a real case where Soleimani, is someone who, during his life, accomplished military feats for which the whole world should be grateful. Not least, of course, the defeat of ISIS.
No, indeed. I just want to just talk a little bit about the Axis of Resistance. I mean, we've often referred to the Axis of Resistance on this show. And I just think for the benefit of any new viewers, I wonder whether you might just sort of say, briefly explain, you know, what it actually means and whether Soleimani was one of its architects.
Well, Soleimani was, of course, the architect of the Axis of Resistance. It's a term which, in a way, is a response to the views of the US president, who announced the the axis of evil.
Yes.
And so, you know, the response to that was to say, well, no, we are not the axis.
Reagan wasn't it?
Yeah, we are the axis of resistance. Yeah. And it's an indication throughout West Asia of those forces which are willing to fight U.S. imperialism and indeed to target and to fight Zionism in Israel. And of course, that's in Iran and many of the forces in Iraq, as Amar has just been saying, in Lebanon, in Syria, and indeed also, of course, in Yemen, where the heroic attempts to resist the Saudi onslaught are ongoing. And of course, the Yemenis are part of that, of what's seen self-consciously as the axis of resistance. This is a very self-conscious sense of almost an organization which is transnational and which fights U.S. imperialism and indeed the Zionists too.
Mm. Well, Amar, I mean, it seems that all the main Palestinian factions paid tribute to Soleimani after his death. I mean, would you say that they saw him as a steadfast ally then?
Yes, Haj Qasem Soleimani was certainly seen as a steadfast ally of the Palestinian resistance. But I think there's something underlying that question, which David's just touched on, which is the accusation that's sometimes made that Palestinians, who are mostly Sunni Muslims, are very anti-Shia and that they hate Iran. But we find that, you know, the people most invested in that narrative are simply trying to play a game of divide and rule. The fact is, at least in the present day, there would be no military resistance in Palestine without the support from the Iranian government. And all the main resistance factions understand that. In fact, they even go to lengths to publicly acknowledge that and to thank Iran. In terms of Qasem Soleimani specifically, we know that Palestinians, you know, many Palestinians, particularly those in Gaza, admire him. They display portraits of him. And even in the West Bank, there are murals of him on the apartheid walls. So he's very well respected in Palestine, and lots of tributes were paid to him upon his martyrdom.
I mean, briefly, it is a question, isn't it, of divide and rule, as Amar was saying there. That's what it certainly seems like that. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you can see that there was a falling out between Hamas and Iran over the question of Syria, because they took different sides in the conflict there.
Yeah,
And of course, that falling out has now been healed over.
Yes.
There's been a concentrated effort by the Iranian government to bring the factions together in Palestine, and there have been conferences throughout the region very recently, and there is now a clear sense of the unity of the Palestinian factions, and that those kinds of divisions that there were only a few years ago are a matter of the past.
Yes, indeed. Well, thanks for that. Anyway, but I mean, I think we're just going to pause there now, if I can, because we've got a report on the cold-blooded assassination of Qasem Soleimani that happened on the 3rd of January 2020.
The martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani in January 2020 will live on in the hearts and minds of millions of people across the world. The illegal killing of General Soleimani was a dastardly move by a petulant empire dwindling in power more and more by the day. But there were other stakeholders in this cursed project. He had a key role in arming all of the resistance forces, from Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad to the PFLP and Fatah. Here, Palestinians can be seen drawing his portrait into the beach of Gaza in a heartfelt show of solidarity. The drones that killed Soleimani were coordinated from the US Ramstein Air Base in Germany. It is claimed that agents at Damascus Airport gave the US information about the time his plane took off for Baghdad. It is believed that the heroic general switched his cell phone 3 times in the 6 hours before his flight. This process was being monitored by Israeli intelligence services in Tel Aviv alongside U.S. Joint Special Operations Command liaisons. 3 U.S. sniper teams from the U.S. Delta Force surrounded Baghdad Airport in preparation for the plane's landing. The U.S. Delta Force operators had positioned themselves disguised as maintenance workers to gain access to the strategic locations. One of the snipers had a camera attached to his weapon, which gave a live stream back to the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, where the Delta Ground Force commander looked on. While 3 U.S. drones hovered overhead, 2 of them with the missiles that would carry out the heinous killing Other agents scurried around underneath, preparing the travesty. A US-incubated Kurdish group, the counter-terrorism group, the CTG, was also involved in the assassination. One of them was disguised as ground crew and guided the plane once it landed on the tarmac. CTG agents disguised as baggage handlers identified the martyr as he stepped off the plane. Another US military unit involved in the killing was the ISA Intelligence Support Activity, also known as Task Force Orange. They scurried around Baghdad, securing the exact coordinates of the martyr's car to line up the drone strikes that stole a hero from this world. Following the killing, a Kurdish agent of the CTG approached the burning vehicle, disguised as a policeman, and photographed the body of the martyr to provide to his US overlords. What they fail to understand is that martyrdom is not death. It is a struggle immortalized and love enduring. Qasem Soleimani lives.
Omar, do you think it's possible that Donald Trump was actually bounced into the assassination by Israel?
It certainly does appear that he was bounced into it by the state of Israel. I think that's a certainly possibility. We know that Trump is not the most savvy or intelligent person. He was routinely manipulated by his advisors. Trump blamed John Bolton, for example, for failing in the plan that Bolton himself had masterminded to overthrow the Venezuelan government. Now, with respect to the assassination of Qasem Soleimani specifically, we know that Trump has only given scant details about it, and he said, quote, that he can't talk about this story, unquote, and that, he was disappointed in the state of Israel, and that, quote, Israel did not do the right thing, unquote. So the evidence certainly appears that he was, in fact, bounced into doing it.
Certainly sounds sinister, to say the least. So, David, I mean, tell us, what was the role of the Kurdish group that were involved in the killing?
So it's an odd-sounding name, isn't it, the counter-terrorism group? Well, that's because it's part of Iraqi Kurd government in Iraqi Kurdistan. So it's actually formally a part of that devolved administration. And it's, of course, as it says in the film, incubated by the US and effectively, in this case, an asset and a pawn of the US and recruited to do that. So you have the Iraqi government, the Iraqi Kurdistan government, actually involved in covert actions within Iraq, which, of course, is an outrage in itself. Mm. And, of course, there was a collaboration, too, with the other government, which generally uses Kurdish groups, which is, of course, the Israelis. So the Israelis were involved directly in the killing as well.
Yeah, I think the former Iraqi prime minister is also implicated in the assassination. Is that right?
Yeah, and there's a question about a court case about whether he will be brought to trial for his involvement in that, and that's a recent development, and we'll have to see how that develops. But that's a very interesting possible future in relation to that in Iraq.
Sure. Omar, I mean, it's not well known, is it, that Soleimani was active in helping to arm all the Palestinian resistance factions, I mean, do you think that undermines the argument that some make that Iran only pursues a narrow interest in Palestine?
It certainly does undermine the idea that Iran is, pursuing some sort of sectarian, narrow, or even selfish interest in Palestine. Haj Qasem Soleimani was active in supporting Fatah, PFLP, as well as Hamas. In fact, another group active in Gaza called Palestinian Islamic Jihad is even closer to Iran than those other groups I just mentioned, but it tends to receive less support from the Iranian government. So this is clearly not a sectarian approach. As David was mentioning, there was that brief period just after the war broke out in Syria in 2011 when Hamas actually split with Iran. But even after that split, which was a very big and public split, we now see that relations have healed between Iran and Hamas, and Iran continues to support them, even though they clearly have very different views about wider policy in West Asia. So this is not a narrow approach by Iran.
Mm. So, I mean, what Omar was saying there then, David, it seems to contradict, doesn't it, the notion that Iran is a sectarian actor in the region, doesn't it?
Well, I think if you look at the region as a whole and the axis of resistance, the various parts of the axis of resistance, you see that that kind of argument just doesn't hold any water at all. I mean, the involvement of the supporting the Syrian government, which is not an Islamic government, which is a secularist government, but which nevertheless, of course, is supported by Iran. And likewise, the Syrian government itself putting out statements saying that it supports all the factions in Palestine, regardless of the words which they have in their names, by which is meant the word Islamic or the word jihad. So, of course, there's a clear sense there that they've got a common interest, and that's not defined by being secular or Islamic or by being Sunni or Shia. It's defined by a general common interest, and that puts the lie to that idea that this is about sectarianism.
Yeah, well, I mean, Amara, I mean, what was the response? I wonder if you could say something about the response of the people in the region to the slaying of Soleimani.
Well, Haj Qasem Soleimani was deeply, deeply respected by millions of people, not just in Iran, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, you know, the entire region, not just in West Asia, but also beyond. He has been active, as we've been sort of discussing, for many, many, many years. And this sort of caricaturing of him in the West as some sort of Osama bin Laden character or just some, you know, random person that most people in the West, I don't think, have necessarily even heard about, is completely at odds with the way in which he was viewed in West Asia, which was really as an actual hero. In fact, we heard this commentary after Qasem Soleimani was martyred, that Iran could never effectively take revenge against the United States for that killing because, the United States doesn't have real heroes. They have characters like SpongeBob and Spider-Man. You know, this was a bona fide hero. This is the way in which he was viewed by those people because of the actions he'd undertaken, over decades.
Well, David, I mean, what can we say about the legacy of Qasem Soleimani?
I think the legacy is in the practical effect that his activities have had on the ability of people in the axis of resistance to collaborate with each other, and indeed inside Palestine, of the ability of the Palestinian factions to collaborate with each other. The Unity Intifada of May 2021, after his death, is a standing tribute to him, the fact that all the Palestinian factions got together and they still remain together in a unified, even though the Israelis are trying to split them apart and trying to split Palestinian Islamic Jihad off from Hamas and that kind of thing. The resistance is unified and much stronger than it has been for many, many years. And that is directly because of Haj Soleimani's activities.
There's a kind of real kind of unifying figure then, we might say.
He was, I mean, in life and in death.
I mean, That's what I mean, yeah.
And even in last May in the Unity Intifada, we had his successor directly involved in a war room in Beirut with Hezbollah and with the Palestinian factions, directing the activities of the Palestinian factions inside occupied Palestine. So that's an indication of the practical effect of that.
Sure, yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because, unfortunately, we're out of time. So I'd like to thank our guest, Amar Qasmi, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. Hope you found the programme interesting and enlightening. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight. According to the most recent statistics, there are now 4,760 Palestinian political prisoners in the Zionist regime's jails, with the Zionist regime enjoying huge support from the U.S. and the European Union. It faces no consequences for the abuse of prisoners. Apart from issuing timid statements of concern, the powerful allow the Zionist regime's cruelty to go unchallenged. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "Adjusting to reality outside the confines of an Israeli regime prison is not easy." Alian Al-Amour has found out that, "The sense of freedom I have now is strange," the 43-year-old said, adding, "When I walk, I find it hard to believe I can move without anyone stopping me." On the day after his release in September, Alian met his fiancée, Dina, for the first time. The couple got engaged while Alian was in prison, but Dina was never able to visit him. Alian and Dina married within a few weeks of their first meeting. It was an important step toward ensuring that Alian can rebuild his life. The horrors he encountered behind bars cannot be erased from his memory. His long period of detention began in September 2006. Alian was at home in Al-Fukhari near the Gaza city of Khan Yunus when Israeli regime troops invaded the area and arrested him. He was quickly brought to Ashkelon prison inside the occupied territories, where he was kept for 35 days. During that period, he was held underground and was repeatedly beaten and threatened by his Israeli interrogators. Alian believes that his interrogators wanted to coerce him into confessing to something he had not done. Over the next 3 years, Alian was brought to court on numerous occasions. He noted, "The bus used to transport him looked good on the outside, but inside there were iron bars, handcuffs, and armed troops." Although the trip to court should have been short, the Zionist regime authorities would often keep Alian handcuffed inside the bus for long periods. It was not unusual for Alian to be held in the bus for 3 full days as the drivers transported him and other Palestinians between the court and various prisons. 3 years after his trial began, Alian, who had worked in the Palestinian Authority's security forces, was sentenced to a lengthy jail term over allegations that he was involved in resistance activities. He spent a total of 16 years behind bars, mostly in Ramon prison. Throughout his time in jail, Alian was held in harsh conditions. As he was in reasonably good health, Alian was arguably a little more fortunate than other prisoners. He became increasingly conscious of how the conditions exacerbated the health problems of prisoners who were unwell. Alian wanted to help those with medical issues, yet for most of the time, all he was able to do was communicate with them remotely, via lawyers or by sending verbal messages when he met other prisoners on buses, heading to and from court and offer some moral support. That changed in 2019. Early that year, he submitted a request to join a group of prisoners who work in Ramal Prison Clinic. His request was accepted by the authorities. Initially, he was excited by how he had an opportunity to do what he wanted. His excitement turned to shock as soon as he saw the cruelty inflicted on Palestinian patients in Ramel. He said, "It was like a slaughterhouse. I will never forget the sight of patients on my first day there. Their hands were cuffed to the beds. Their faces looked sad and exhausted. And I could see from thin bodies how severely ill they were. There was no doubt that the hospital was not taking care of them." Along with a few other prisoners, Alian assisted patients who required help to eat and take medicine or who had mobility issues. At times, he would raise patients' complaints with lawyers or with the clinic's administration. A number of patients Alian met in Ramel had cancer. The services offered to cancer patients were, he noted, completely inadequate. For chemotherapy and other essential treatments, cancer patients were transferred to hospitals that were larger. Once a week, guards at the Rommel clinic would carry out an inspection, generally at night time. During it, patients were moved to a yard for a number of hours, no matter what the weather was like. Prisoners with medical needs frequently faced an ordeal. The Israeli regime authorities can stall on processing prisoners' applications for hospital treatment. It is not uncommon, according to Alian, for 18 months or 2 years to elapse between an application for such treatment and a final decision. Sometimes the authorities reject requests, he said. There are hundreds of prisoners with health problems, but they are afraid of the Zionist hospitals because of the deliberate negligence. I haven't seen a patient get better in the hospital. The patients only leave in coffins. It is very sad. The three of Ramle's patients died in the few years that Alian worked in the clinic. Among them was Bassam Al-Say, 46, from Nablus, in the occupied West Bank. Al-Say had leukemia and died in September 2019. Bassam used to say, "I want to go back to Gaza with you and eat fish on the beach," Alian said. That was in the last few days of his life. I held back my tears and told him, "It would be wonderful if we could go to the beach in Gaza together." As well as visiting patients in Ramle Clinic, Alian reached out to some other prisoners who were ill. One of them, Sami Al-Amur, was a relative from Deir al-Balah in Gaza. Alian would send verbal messages to Sami via other prisoners. Last year, doctors recommended that Sami should have surgery for blocked arteries. But rather than being taken to hospital, Sami was kept in prison. Alian argued that keeping Sami in prison was tantamount to a death sentence. Alian added, "They knew how critical his condition was. Sami died in Zionist regime custody during November last year. He was only 39. The horrors which Alian Al-Amur encountered have been witnessed by so many others." Meanwhile, Palestinian Wafa News Agency reported Muhammad Masrawa, 25, from Tulkarm, lost sight in his right eye after Israeli regime occupation troops assaulted him during his arrest at his family's house on January 20 of this year. They said the prisoners and ex-prisoners affairs condition had reported this news. It said in a statement that Israeli regime troops assaulted Masrawa, currently in Israeli regime custody, with the rifle butts on his head and forehead, which caused a severe injury to the forehead that led to losing vision in his right eye. It said Masrawa was supposed to undergo an operation on his eye this month, but that the Zionist regime prison services cancelled the operation on the pretext that he is going to finish his sentence in April of next year, after serving a year and a half in prison for resisting the occupation. The commission said Masrawa suffers from severe stomach pains and that he was given medication for a short period before the prison clinic stopped it without any reason. Masrawa is a former prisoner who spent 20 months in the Zionist regime prisons.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, and researcher in the house Elvia of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Many have told me that your teen years are the best part of your life, though to me and my peers it does not seem so. They're filled with strife, they're filled with tears, these growing up years. I was a child before with no worries, none at all, but I am not that young no more. As an adult, since I fall, I realize that life's not that easy at all. I have to make decisions now, but the hardest part of all is trying to fit in, knowing how to tie in bow or a pin, knowing what to wear, jeans or a hat, knowing what to say, soft or loud, as I'm trying to fit in with the crowd. Looking in the mirror, I see me, trying to be me, not who I am, but who they are. As a teen, I have a lot of worries that before I had never seen, until it starts as I first encounter love and discover broken hearts, as it's all I talk of. Professor Nakavi, a very warm welcome. As a teenager goes through different states of life, I recited this poem from Janik Tenbod, and the last part of it says that as a teen, the first thing when I get into the relationships, I realize the heart breaks. Why is it so? Why are teens are not into perfect social relationships? Why do they experience heartbreaks at the very first stage of their life when they start developing social relationships?
And that is, as I said, as you were saying, it's a very sensitive, delicate transformation that is taking place. And of course, we have to relish each and every stage of our lives. It should be with gratitude. It should be with the love of Allah Almighty. It should be with thanking Allah Almighty. with being patient because of Allah Almighty. In all our days in this world, we need to have these attributes, these attitudes. But the sensitive age of adolescence is when a person is starting to become an old adult person. And things, it's just like somehow you could say Adam and Eve realizing that they need clothes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, metaphorically, I would say not exactly the same thing, but it's something, it's a dawning of a new thing.
Yeah.
So it's a new era in life.
True.
It can be very exciting. It can be used positively. It could be in a way that we benefit from it in the utmost way, because at that time our thoughts and our feelings are pure.
Yeah.
Till now we have not done anything which could make us sinful. We're starting to become a person who, by cutting out things which are not allowed,
would be a responsible person.
We would be responsible for those actions. Therefore, it is a very important stage in life. It can become a stage where, if we start off with a sound footing, a proper understanding of the situation. The problem is mostly we don't understand what we are going through. And that is the problem, which is because of our system of education mostly.
Yeah.
We teach our children